Of opinion in my constituency, and indeed if you look at the opinion polls, the majority of people support civil partnerships as I do, but feel that same-sex marriage legislation is a step too far.
Warwickshire County Council has been fined £30,000 for health and safety failures linked to a warehouse blaze in which four firefighters died. A judge said the deaths 5 years ago were caused by a series of mishaps and failures which occurred together. Hillary Clinton has asked all sides in Northern Ireland to confront the challenges of sectarian division peacefully. The US Secretary of State has been speaking in Belfast, where death threats have been made against an MP over a decision to restrict the flying of the Union flag at City Hall. The stepfather of the Only Way is Essex sisters, Sam and Billy Fares, has been sentenced to 4 years in jail. David Chatwood admitted conspiring to steal £1 million worth of gold and silver bullion from a lorry in Belgium last year. That's the latest. I'm Nick Koresh.
BCFM 93.2.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Labour councillor for Cambury Heath. That's sitting on Filton Council, Martin Farmer. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, hundreds of people every night now need free meals in Bristol. We talked to one Alan Goddard, one of the people who provides those meals, plus Central Asia, Afghanistan, Pakistan and the Middle East. Are we only there after oil, or is it drugs as well? And when will we have to pull out? We hear from Iranian channel Press TV, now banned here in Britain by the broadcasting regulator Ofcom. Plus, from last week, an insight into African and Somali politics and journalism as we hear from Omar Farouk Osman, the president of the Federation of African Journalists, who's also the chief of the Somali Journalists Union. Plus, Martin Summers' weekly tour of world hotspots. That's all in the second hour. After six, on to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 1 Celsius and dry with some gusty winds. This weekend, highs of 9 Celsius, colder and sunnier on Saturday, slightly warmer but cloudier on Sunday. Next week, highs of 3 Celsius, sunnier towards the beginning of the week, cloudier midweek on with the possibility of some light rain or snow, so turning nasty. Next weekend, the 15th and 16th of December, highs of 3 degrees Celsius, cloudy with the possibility of light snow. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Labour councillor for Filton, actually for Cadbury Heath, and on Filton Council, Martin Farmer. Hi, Martin. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony. Thanks for having me.
Now, first of all, you have some problem I heard in the news during the week with youth centres up there.
Yeah, I think we probably later on we'll be talking about cuts, but these are cuts, central government cuts, that have now actually started to be fed down right onto the front line in youth centres in in Cadbury Heath. And I think the government always says that cuts are not going to affect the front line, but this means that our youth centre is going to be closed for most of the week, and it's going to lose some staff who've been doing a great job in the local community.
Can you, for those that don't know the area very well, in this particular youth centre, what is the youth centre called, and what kind of activities are going on? To what extent is it open at the moment?
So it's Cadbury Heath Youth Centre. It's currently open four nights a week. All age groups attend. A lot of work's gone into having a music suite. There's also the local youth centre manager gets involved in sort of educational subjects with the youngsters, and really it's somewhere safe that that youngsters in that area can go. As I say, four nights a week. What's going to happen in the future is that the management at the youth centre is also going to be shared with other youth centres in South Gloucestershire, which means that youngsters aren't going to have somewhere safe to go, especially on a Friday night.
Why is it that this has to happen, though? Because surely it doesn't take more than one or two people, maybe even with the help of some volunteers, to run a youth centre. Surely they can afford to employ South Gloucestershire Council can afford to employ at least one or two people to run the place, and maybe even to manage some more voluntary help.
And I think you've probably hit the nail on the head there. I think the big problem is that the that the all the local South Gloucestershire politicians are scrapping over pennies. And I think this is what makes it such a travesty, because in the big scheme of things, to run a youth centre, it's fairly sort of, I mean, you're not talking about a lot of money, and yet South Gloucestershire politicians are actually refusing to fund it, or rather to cut funding. Like I said, I think one of the big issues is that there's been cuts at the government level. Those have been fed down through South Gloucestershire, which is the majority of politicians are, and you can guess it, yeah, they're Conservatives, they're Tories. They haven't pushed back on those funding cuts whatsoever. And like I say, yeah, it's being fed down to a youth centre, which, like I said, in the big scheme of thing, it's just pennies to run a youth centre.
But
like
I mean,
that.
Okay, so you've got things like a music facility there. I mean, that is going to be only open now. A lot of money's been spent on that, and yet exactly. It's only going to be open this one night a week now. Two nights a week.
Yeah. And the other nights, you know, young people, and there's some. You know, some great young people in Cadbury Heath. They're just literally going to be kicking their heels for the rest of the week, and also it's like I said, it's somewhere that they can go to. It's somewhere that's safe, and it does question what are those youngsters going to do for the rest of the week.
Well, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. We got two Martins tonight, so it'll be a little bit confusing. But Martin Summers, can you tell us about the sort of all of the macroeconomics behind this? Because we keep hearing that we do have to have these cuts in order to bring down the deficit. And obviously we've had the autumn-winter stroke statement this week from the Chancellor of Exchequer George Osborne explaining that they are trying to get this deficit down. Ultimately, surely there's going to have to be cuts like this, even though it may be only for a few years. Ultimately those cuts will be over, and then hopefully the youth centre will be able to open properly again, and those facilities that the public's invested in, including this music suite, will actually be available to many more children rather than just open two nights a week.
Well, I think actually the strategy behind this is not to reopen these kind of public facilities and to actually change the nature of the economy to a more private sector looking economy, which fits in with the ideology of the government. But in actual fact, of course, the real news this week is that the population as a whole has finally rumbled what the government is up to, and that in actual fact the cuts are actually making the deficit worse. That is what the IMF has been saying, that's what various independent economists have been saying all along, including me on this programme many times. I said 2.5 years ago, what will happen about halfway into this parliament, you will find a situation where the deficit is actually increasing because of the cuts. If you cut public expenditure in a situation like this where world demand is extremely weak, what happens is that your economy starts to go backwards. And if your economy starts to go backwards, you lose tax revenues and you spend more on housing benefit, for example. The housing benefit bill's going up even though the government is trying to cut individual payments. And that's because that's how a national economy functions. It's not really a surprise. And the more cuts are carried through now, the worse the deficit is going to get. The credit rating agencies are circling above George Osborne's head saying, we're going to cut your credit rating, which was always going to be the case. And so all of this pain has been for nothing.
No, but Martin, the private sector is going to lift us out of this problem by producing jobs.
Well, what's happened up to now is the cooling and general going backwards of the economy has been covered up by an increase in employment, part-time employment at low levels of pay, because we've got a very deregulated labour market in Britain. But that's about to change. I mean, but virtually all independent analysts now suggest that unemployment is going to start rising in Britain. It's already quite high. Don't forget, we've got residual unemployment going back to the last recession, which was never got rid of. In my lifetime, and I'm 53, there's never been less than 1 million unemployed people in this country. Now, in actual fact, that's the reality. And talking about, oh, well, we're going to go back to normal is 1 million unemployed, and that isn't normal. And in actual fact, what's going to happen, I fear, is that if everybody pursues austerity, including the British, then the world economy is actually teetering on the potential for a crash. And once you've had a crash and the banks crash, then we're in a totally different universe from the one that
surely that's a lot better universe, because we can start again.
Yes, but you could say we'll start again after we've lost half the world's population, because that's possibly what might entail. I mean, basically, are people already starving in this country, never mind in other countries? A crash is going to be extremely traumatic, but we've got to make sure that if we do have to go through that for the second time in a generation, we make sure that those responsible are held responsible.
Now, Martin Farmer, what's your take on all this macroeconomic stuff? Do you think that there is any way that central government policy could be changed and altered in order to make things better for you at essentially is the front line, isn't it? We hear a lot about the macroeconomics from Martin there, from George Osborne, and our politicians up in Westminster are pontificating about it. But I mean, what are your thoughts as someone that's seeing the implementation of these cuts at the front line?
I think what you're seeing is people up in the big house up in Westminster making these cuts. I think that's the problem. It's all about cuts. There's nothing about growth at all. And I think until the policy changes, you're going to find things like we're now seeing in Cadbury Heath. You know, if I just sort of sidetrack just for a second, I mean, Cadbury Heath, I mean, compared to other parts in South Gloucestershire, it's more of its fair share of unemployment, poverty, drugs, debt, deprivation. The people also in communities such as Cadbury Heath, they also feel, and this might take us down another rabbit hole, but it's they don't feel connected with politics. And to be honest, I think the government just doesn't. Well, the Tories just don't care, because even though you've got these issues, people are disconnected from politics. So basically, the government, the Tories, will just keep putting more and more hurt onto those communities, because those people feel disconnected from politics, and the Conservatives know that it's not going to cause them any harm. It won't cause them, the Tories, any harm.
Surely, I mean, partly that's your fault, Martin, because you're a councillor and you're a politician. Isn't it your job partly to get people connected with politics? I mean, your party, the Labour Party, has done a lot, which is actually quite similar to the Tories over the years. For example, helping, sort of shifting along the privatisation of the post office, beginning the process of a privatisation of the National Health Service. So it's not surprising, is it, that people are a bit disillusioned with Labour?
Yeah, I think a lot of the problem actually with the I think when it comes to politics, and I think what was the figure I heard the other day, that was 97% of politicians have never worked on the shop floor. I think that's where the disconnect comes from there. And all due respect to people who go to Oxford and Cambridge, but a lot of them are ex Oxbridge graduates. Then go into work in politics, work in these various think tanks, and then take a career in politics.
Well, it's certainly true for your leader, isn't it? And for Nick Clegg and David Cameron, they've been sort of PR spin doctors and theoreticians. They've never really worked. What about you yourself?
Well, I grew up in a council house just in North Somerset in a place called Pill. Parents who worked for the National Health Service lost their job when Thatcher came in, and then I think five or six hospitals actually closed around Bristol, including Ham Green, which is now a housing estate. I literally joined the aerospace industry in Filton at 16, so started off on the shop floor, and then just slowly worked my way up through the organisation. I currently work for Rolls Royce, so. Yeah, that's my background.
Okay, so what are you actually doing now? Because you're talking about people on the shop floor. Are you on the shop floor still?
No, I'm now basically in, I suppose a junior or middle management position within Rolls Royce, within sales and marketing.
Okay, well, let's have a look a little bit more closely at this week's autumn statement. I mean, first of all, I'm a bit annoyed that it's an autumn statement. I've been trying to find out why we have an autumn statement in winter this year. It appears that it's been delayed several weeks. And so that's why. I mean, maybe Martin Summers, maybe there's been a little bit of head scratching going on at Downing Street or number 11 Downing Street over what is actually going to be announced this week.
Well, you may be right. It's hard to guess, isn't it? I mean, originally, of course, we used to have a budget in April, and that was the big deal of the year. But, of course, that just talks about raising revenue. This is about spending. And so we've got these two big hits a year, one the budget in April and now the autumn statement. In fact, don't forget that winter doesn't start till December the 21st. And this is the, so some of the first 2012, as we all know, is when the world's going to end. So no doubt, it did cost them a bit of thinking to try and decide what they were going to say and about now, the government's policy being in such a mess.
Basically. One of the statements is that the Office of Budget Responsibility says trade, not austerity, is to blame for lower growth. Now, what do they mean by that?
Well, what they mean by that is that they're trying to put the blame for Britain's poor performance on the problems in the Eurozone and elsewhere. But in actual fact, Britain has performed badly compared to Eurozone countries and compared to the US. Basically, Chancellor Osborne, by talking up the danger of a deficit spiral and so on, actually caused the economy to stagnate. And Alistair Darling, the previous Chancellor, has been on the airwaves this week pointing out that now he's decided that he's going to cut the deficit at the speed he's now going to cut it. That's pretty much the same as what the Labour Party was saying before the election anyway. So all this huffing and puffing has been to get to exactly the same point we were anyway. But of course, what we've done is we've lost massive amounts of gross national product. In other words, they've got us into the same deficit mess as might have been the case anyway, but with lots and lots of growth, or basically jobs and activity destroyed. And of course, the thing about unemployment is you never get that back. Every day a person spends unemployed is a day lost, because they've only got a certain lifespan. So all of this lost output in Britain will never be recovered. And in actual fact, we're now moving to a situation where the Labour Party can accuse the Conservatives of messing up. They have. But we can't go back and rewind the video and do it again differently. We can't, because we're now in an even worse mess than we would otherwise have been. That's why the Labour Party will have to be more radical in what it's prepared to do.
Well,
it's not just a question of reversing the existing cuts.
Before we have a listen to how radical Ed Balls is, the Shadow Chancellor, let's have a listen to George Osborne this week.
Tougher economic conditions mean that while our deficit is forecast to go on falling, instead of taking 3 years to get our debt falling, it's going to take four.
We show our determination to do this fairly, with further savings from bureaucracy, from the benefits bill and from the better off.
£18 billion a year has been cut from the welfare bill. Benefits are being capped for the first time. So families out of work will not get more than the average family gets for being in work.
Well, this is surely is a great thing, Martin Farmer, Labour councillor for Cadbury Heath, to make sure that people in benefits are not getting more money than people in work.
Yeah, I don't buy that. I think we're having a conversation earlier, actually. It's was it people on benefits spend all the money they've got? Millionaires don't. So as soon as you start capping benefits or start taking money away, you're actually taking money out of the economy. Now, you give some tax breaks for the rich, and I think, the higher rate of tax is going to be dropped down to 45%. The rich, if you're a millionaire and you've got an extra £100,000, you're not going to spend that. You're just going to stick that. You're going to stick that in the bank. So again, that's more money being taken out of the economy. So now you're getting into this ever increasing tailspin. You take money from people who've got benefits, so they don't spend so much. You give tax breaks for the rich. They go and save money. So that's money all being taken out of the economy, and of course, then you get into bigger problems.
Martin Summers, 3 years instead of four of austerity. So he's had to extend it by a year.
Yes, I mean, the whole point is that austerity is the wrong policy. You shouldn't, in fact, in my view, be cutting public expenditure. There's no case at all for cutting public expenditure in a situation like this.
Now, I can remember this last year. It was, sort of three instead of two. And it's almost like one of those cartoons where someone's kind of going off the cliff, and when you see the next shot, they're still going off the cliff in the same sort of direction. Well, so that every year we're being told, oh, I'm sorry, it's going to have to last another year.
Yes, and what will happen if everybody pursues austerity as they seem to be doing? Obama can't really reflate the economy in the US because the Republicans control the Congress. The euro area is locked in by the European Central Bank's founding documents, which the Germans are unwilling to change. And Britain is committing Harry Kirri on the sidelines by pursuing a debt. We're pursuing a... I mean, the whole point of not being in the euro is we can pursue a policy different from the Europeans. But in actual fact, we're outside the euro so that we can do exactly the same as the Europeans. And I put this to the Tory right wing. I mean, surely the point of being outside the euro is we can see our own policy, isn't it? Oh no, we're going to do exactly the same as them anyway. We're going to cut. Now, if everybody's cutting, where's the demand going to come from in the world economy? Where are these jobs through trade going to come when the Chinese economy is starting to falter? And we don't export much to China anyway. That's the Germans' game. We export to Ireland. That's our biggest trading partner. Didn't realise that before the crisis, but actually they're our biggest trading partner. Now, all this implies is that ultimately we are going to potentially have a crash unless there is a change of direction at the top, and the IMF and the Americans are going to have to lead this if it's going to happen. There is potential for a full-on crash, because don't forget the banks are still insolvent. They're being propped up by the governments of the world. The governments are running out of money, and there's no growth in the world economy. The world economy won't just stagnate. There will be a crash, and when there's a crash, that means that we will lose large chunks of the financial services sector. Will simply disintegrate, and at that point we will then realise why the policy being pursued is so wrong-headed.
Well, that's an interesting reply to George Osborne. Let's now see how the Labour Shadow Chancellor Ed Balls replied.
The national deficit is not rising, is rising, it is not falling. The national debt is... I'll say it again. Our economy is contracting this year. Government borrowing and the deficit is revised up this year, next year and every year. And the national debt is rising, it is not falling. Not snakes and spiders in the jungle, but their fiscal rule broken, their economic credibility in tatters, exposed now as incompetent and unfair. Yes, Mr. Speaker, he's the Chancellor. Can't someone get him out of here?
Well, as Ed Balls, the Shadow Chancellor there, with his slightly cack-handed riposte. Martin Farmer, he was making a lot of actual mistakes about what was happening with the economy there, and also trying to sort of do jokes rather than actually get into the nitty-gritty detail to attack. I mean, of course, that wasn't all that he had to say. But I don't think Ed Balls really came across as very competent, confident or competent. I mean, for many people that might be thinking of voting Labour, he's not a great advert for you, is he?
I think the big problem is that we're all expecting our politicians to become, I suppose, grey suited politicians. I think Ed Balls just came across as being natural. I think he even said himself, didn't he, that I think when you're faced with the Prime Minister, the Chancellor, and however many hundred Tory politicians all baying for your blood, I think that's a pretty stressful situation to be in.
But he's got to be up to the job. I mean, you know, he's actually getting his facts wrong, you know, saying that the deficit isn't rising, and then having to correct himself, say, oh, it is rising. You know, it's not a very competent Martin.
Can I just say, I think what's happened here is George Osborne, with his advisors, did a very crafty thing, which is the sale of the future sale of
4G.
4G. That's been accounted in this year, even though it hasn't taken place yet. So therefore, the figures look better than they otherwise would. And of course, don't forget that Ed Balls only gets to see the brief in front of him literally before, you know, just before he goes on, a bit like this programme. And of course, that was a deliberate elephant trap set by George Osborne, and it just shows how lacking in honesty they are about the situation. Also, I'd just like to remind everybody that all the money we've spent on the banks isn't even included in the national debt, because we're going to get that money back. All those who believe in capitalism believe eventually that these banks will be privatised back to the private sector, and we'll get all the money back that we've spent on them, so we don't count that as public expenditure at all. Well, I've got news for people out there. The money we've spent on the banks is public expenditure, and the second worst thing of all is we're not going to get any of that money back. So in actual fact, the situation is far, far worse than anybody recognises, but that's why you can't be cutting public expenditure.
So we're running basically the entire economy on a cross fingers and a 4G.
Yeah. But I think, back to your original point, though, I think, isn't it ironic that some newspapers have actually focused on the way that Ed Balls actually responded and his speech, rather than actually the facts?
Well, the trouble is, when he you know, he's got that chance as he gets the floor to make mincemeat of George Osborne potentially, but he doesn't really seem to have that ability to cut to the real issues and to undermine Osborne, as certainly politicians used to do sort of 10, 20 years ago. They would be much more direct and cutting. And Martin's saying about them not having, the other Martin, saying about him not having a lot of access is possibly one of the reasons for that. Yeah. One of the big changes in the autumn statement, of course, is this 3-year freeze on, not freeze, but cap on benefits of 1%. for the next 3 years. This is the first time this has ever happened, because benefits have always followed inflation up until now. Martin Summers, what's going to be the effect of that? Because there's no guarantees that inflation isn't going to actually go up quite a lot more than 1% over the next 3 years.
In other words, this is a real terms cut in benefits. And of course, this is entirely political. What George Osborne wants to do is for the Labour Party to vote against these cuts in benefits. And then he says, oh, yes, the Labour Party, the friend of the scroungers. Now, in actual fact, as Ed Balls has pointed out, 80% of benefits go to people who are in work, so it's actually an attack on the working poor. And the other point, of course, is that all of this is simply taking demand out of the economy. And in actual fact, the last thing you should be doing in a situation like this is cutting public expenditure and cutting benefits. In Iceland, which are doing rather well, they've put the bankers in prison, they've refused to pay the debts that they ran up, and they've increased unemployment benefits, so they know that's what people need. Why can't we do that in this country? Oh, well, because we can't. And I think that's just to do with the history of this country and the kind of class war that comes from the top, from the people at the top. They love the idea of grinding the faces of the poor. Well, we've got to throw that back in their faces. This is absolutely irrational.
But surely this is just
wrong,
Martin,
picking on
that's not what they're doing here. What they're doing here is trying to manage the economy. They're not trying to grind the faces of the poor.
No. If they were trying to manage the economy, they'd be increasing benefits. In actual fact, we've got to move to a society probably where we have a citizen's income, not a universal credit, a citizen's income. This is the kind of way they talk in Finland.
Where's the money going to come from for that?
Ultimately, the money comes from two sources. A, you grow the economy, so you've actually got money coming in because it's going somewhere rather than backwards. And B, you really do tax the rich, because we can't just live on the never-never. And that means we have a one-off wealth tax to close the deficit. And that means we don't look at people's income, we look at what they're actually worth, and we say we want 10% of that. One-off. Bang, crash, and off we go. Now, we're not ready to do that yet. Ed Balls isn't ready to do that yet. One of the problems Ed Balls has got is that he was in charge of the economy when it all went down the tubes. And in fact, the Labour Party did miss a trick. We should have regulated the city. There should have been a tougher...
Well, I'll tell you, what other way you missed a trick is keeping Ed Balls on, because, you know, he's seen to be the guy that mismanaged things in the first place, and he's now the one that is supposed to be at least answering some of these new policies of Osborne's. He's the wrong man for the job.
He's the right man for the job because he actually understands the ins and outs of it. The problem is that he was associated with the previous regime. And
but he doesn't know whether the deficit's rising or falling.
No, that's because basically he was sold an elephant trap there anyway. The point is that all of this is missing the point. Let's get the fundamental point through to people listening to this show. Cutting public expenditure does not decrease the deficit. It increases the deficit as a percentage of GDP, which is what the ratings agencies are interested in. Now, ultimately, what's going to happen is that the government is going to lose the country's credit rating because it's been carrying out cuts. And at that point, the Liberal Democrats will have a nervous breakdown. The coalition will break down, and we'll have an election before the planned date, in my view.
Martin Farmer, do you think some of this is lost on people in Cadbury Heath? Do you think people in Cadbury Heath are they're expecting someone to sort this out, aren't they? And it doesn't look like it's going to be sorted out.
I think it's back to one of my original points. I think the in Cadbury Heath and places like it, I think there is that disconnection. There is the disconnection with politics. And, you know, this is all very complex stuff that's happening up in Westminster. It's not until, it actually gets to the, as we said before, gets to the front line, actually starts hitting people's pockets. You know, people are now starting to make the choice about, do we heat or do we eat? Do we pay our rent or do we pay our mortgage or do other things? So I think some of the bigger picture stuff is lost on people. But having said that, the bigger picture stuff is now actually hitting people down in communities such as Cadbury Heath, and it's hitting them big time.
What about this the final little thing on the autumn statement? Is no new tax on property, Martin? Martin Summers, you've been banging your fist on the table here for the last couple of years, saying we need to tax property because it can't run away like the wealth that's in the Cayman Islands and the tax havens.
That's right, and I believe that the Liberal Democrats were pushing their mansion tax, which is a kind of a step in the right direction, and of course Osborne gave them nothing. Now, ultimately, this is a class budget by the ruling class, and they're going to try and make the poorest people pay. And they know that these people are disconnected from politics, as you say, Martin, and they know that if they were to get connected to politics, they might vote for us, so that's no good to them either. So in actual fact, even the standard spending assessments for local authorities have been skewed in favour of Tory areas. It's absolutely blatant. They're feather bedding their own voters in the comfortable shires and making sure that all the pain is suffered in the inner cities and in the deprived communities. And that actually is not one nation conservatism by any stretch of the imagination. But what they've got to remember is, if you start a class war from the top, then you might get one from the bottom. And ultimately, the British people do have a sense of fairness, and they are going to react very strongly to this.
Martin Farmer, with the complexities of this autumn statement, what can you say to people in Cadbury Heath to say, yes, you should be voting for me?
That's a good question. I think I'm with Martin. I think we've got 30 months now, 29 months to the next election, if not before. I think some of the pain is going to get so tough. Not only just on the communities that we talked about like Cadbury Heath, but also in some of the Middle England type communities as well. Because don't forget that it's working people as well that they're actually picking up benefits. I've got a feeling, and I'm not hoping against hope by any means, but I've got a feeling you're actually going to see a backlash within the next 29 months. But it will all be about those Labour in the next 29 months reconnecting with the voters that it actually lost over those years from 97 through to 2010.
Well, one of the other effects is also in the news this week. Well, two, actually. One is a scholarship with benefits, sex for tuition site exposed. A tuition money would be received in exchange for two-hour sessions with men in hotel rooms or private flats up to four times per term. The website claims to have undertaken such arrangements for 1,400 students. This is a website called sponsorascholar.co.uk, where students can register and get money for going to visit men in private flats in order to help with their tuition fees. The other one is hackers using government job sites to steal your data in the knowledge that there is a government people are so desperate for jobs that they will hand over any information to a website. Well, what happened was one organisation put a fake ad on there and managed to harvest all sorts of personal information, including photocopies of people's passports. Now, this is all coming from a sort of state of desperation where people are so desperate for work, Martin Farmer.
Yeah, that's. I think
you're right. Money, for the tuition fees.
Yeah, exactly. I think with the, the sex for tuition site which has been exposed. I think I think it's terrible. I think it just goes to show the desperation, how desperate people actually are. And I must admit, this is the first time I've actually read this evening. Yeah,
The website offered young women sponsorship from strangers in exchange for private encounters. Allegedly, a pretty student could cover up to, around about £12,000 a year of tuition fees, depending on the level of intimacy she was willing to demonstrate.
So it just goes to show...
This has been closed, this website, by the way, sponsorascholar.co.uk.
Just goes to show the level of desperation and the situation that, the country faces itself. And I think even tonight, I think tonight you're... you've got somebody who's running a cafe for people who need to eat. And I think that's the situation where we're finding ourselves in. It's things are getting a lot worse and seems to be getting worse for it quite quickly.
Martin, what's your thoughts on these two stories this week?
Well, I think I think the young people of this country are really, really the victims of everything that's been going on. If you think about the level of unemployment, the virtual impossibility of leaving further education without huge debts and no possibility of employment to pay those debts back, a whole generation is being thrown on the scrap heap just like the 1980s. And I hasten to remind the people in charge that these people are all of military age. And ultimately, if you don't do something to give them a constructive stake in society, they will find other ways to make themselves listened to and make themselves heard. We saw the rioting last August, the August before. I don't approve of that, but you can see that there's a potential for something like that to really take off. And as we saw in Northern Ireland 30 years ago, once something like that starts, it's very difficult to stop it.
Okay, so one of the outcomes of all this is homelessness. And on ITV at 9 o'clock last night, there was an interesting documentary called Madeley Meets the Squatters. And this was on national television, and Bristol featured quite heavily. So let's hear an extract from that now.
My search to meet Britain's squatters has brought me to Bristol, which after London has become another mecca for squatting. Unofficial estimates say around 1,000 people are squatting in the city. And I'd heard they'd organise themselves into groups so they can squat more effectively. They've got their own shop, community centre, they've even got their own planning committee.
This is a meeting of the Bristol Housing Action Movement, BAM they call it, and they meet every week, and they meet just like a housing committee, except it's to do with squats.
After several weeks of negotiating, I'm finally being allowed into one of the meetings.
Hiya, thanks for seeing me.
Everyone in this room is, or has been, a squatter. They meet each week, trying to help people to find new places to live in.
It's like the alternative Bristol Planning Committee.
We're not the council, but more efficient.
Well,
we collect a levy, so anybody who's got any spare change, please put it in the middle. Yeah, whatever you can spare is fine.
This whip round pays for tools to make new squats habitable.
Okay, next on the agenda is homelessness. Anybody here homeless tonight? Anybody near?
A couple of last stragglers from New Street are homeless, but we're looking up for new buildings currently. Okay, we've got a couple of possibilities.
We've got a list of empties, and we can sort you out with a few places to go and look at.
Oh, okay, cool.
Tonight, yeah.
Yeah.
So am I right to assume that an empty is an unoccupied building, isn't it?
Yeah, and unlike any building that's not being used by anyone else.
So in that case, really, these weekly meetings are to rehouse homeless people in squats. That's it, isn't it?
Yeah, the process of squatting is you occupy a building and then you get evicted, and then you occupy a building, you get evicted.
It's open to anyone. Anyone can come along, present themselves as homeless, and we'll try our best to sort them out. Yeah. You don't need to be claiming housing benefits or signing on. You just turn up. You have a chat with us, and we see what we can do. We see if we can get you in any old squats, or we see if we can find you a new one, or if there's several different homeless people, we'll group them, try and group them together to find a new place. I like to sort of think of us as like urban wombles. We roam the streets.
You may like to think of us.
We look for things that aren't being used, and we make a use of them.
Yeah.
How can you argue the moralities of that? Like, when the banks, they're not poor, they own several properties, we use them for practical use. Mm. We don't pay rent, no, but at least, you know, people aren't sleeping rough.
Well, Tristan, the urban womble there, talking about the banks. And it's interesting because Martin Farmer, it'd be interesting your views on this. It's quite controversial, the idea of houses being taken over. But one of the ones recently, which was squatted, it was in the Post, was actually an old bank.
Yeah, I must admit, I quite admire them, actually. It's, you know, in the moment, there's a lack of affordable housing. You know, what we're seeing, rents are going up. I sometimes follow the rental market. I just find it quite amazing that almost on a monthly basis, rents are rising. So, also in addition, I think in South Gloucestershire, I think we need to build 28,000 houses, I think, in the next 10 years. And literally, there's not enough housing to go around. What housing there is, landlords are sort of ripping people off more and more, and of course when people are on benefits, then they've got to go back and claim more money for their rent, so you get into this vicious circle. So yeah, occupy a bank, that seems to be a great advert,
a bit of a no-brainer. Martin Summers, what's your take on the reason why rents are going up so much? I mean, even though there's a recession, it seems that actually rents are not, they're certainly not going down, are they?
Well, that's because there's an undersupply of affordable housing for people at the bottom end of the scale. We haven't built it, there has not been any serious council house building during the Labour era, for example.
But these people are moving
one of the issues,
these people are moving into houses that aren't theirs, or at least buildings.
Well, I mean, they've been doing it for at least 30, 40 years, as far as I remember.
Might be several hundred years.
Several hundred years, but I mean, I used to squat in London in the 1980s, and lots of people I squatted with formed housing cooperatives and then got funding from the Housing Corporation to turn those squats into housing cooperatives. These people are David Cameron's big society. They're not sitting on their backside. They're getting out there and doing something. And of course, there is a very well-established procedure for dealing with this. People are evicted and moved on when buildings are necessary are being done up. And for example, at the beginning of the so-called Tesco riot, the lads who were in there were doing the place up because they'd agreed to move on. So they were cleaning the place up when the police burst in there. And that's generally speaking, squatting and has not been illegal in this country since the Middle Ages. And there is all sorts of established procedures for dealing with it. And it's a safety valve for people who haven't got anywhere to live. And if people think that everybody in this country's got somewhere decent to live, they're living in cloud cuckoo land, or they're a Tory party activist.
And I think, yeah, if companies are just hanging on to empty properties in the hope that the value will rise, then, yeah, if if I think that's a fair target for people to go in there and
squat. Well, we did have a guy called Tony Crofts on here who runs a housing co-op up in Clifton, a very nice place with a nice view as well, I have to say. And he was saying that there is something like 1.75 million square feet of empty office space in the city as well. So there's an immense amount of property out there that's not being used properly. I mean, one would have thought that if Osborne had his head screwed on, he would be thinking about taxing some of that to try and get some of the value of that property from these people and actually forcing them to rent it out. You know, there doesn't seem to be any proper market in that kind of property.
Well, don't forget that the people who own those buildings will be making money on the book value of the buildings, you know, on what it says on paper, not what they're actually worth. If they rented them out, they might find out they're worth a lot less than they're claiming. And on the back of the money that they make on that, they then fund the Conservative Party to be the government. And that's why the policy is as it is.
And I think just another statistic, I think it came out yesterday from Shelter, was that 85,000 children will be without a home this Christmas. 85,000, that just seems to be a staggering figure.
One place that won't be squatted, hopefully, is Hinkley Point B nuclear power station near Bridgewater, although maybe, because there are some people campaigning down there, aren't there? So you should never say that nowhere's going to be squatted, but I can't quite see it somehow. Squatters don't really like sitting next to nuclear reactors, I would imagine. Ooh. But anyway, that nuclear power station, and also Hunterston B in North Ayrshire, started generation in 1976, but have now been given 7-year extensions to their existing decommissioning dates in 2016. Now this goes against my logic. I would have thought that if one of these power stations has been designed to run for a certain period of time, then it should be closed down. The idea of giving it a 7-year extension could be potentially dangerous. Martin Summers, you first on this.
Well, I mean, people have been saying that the Fukushima plant was running way over its agreed lifetime. I think from an economic point of view, one of the things you want to do with plants like this is, once you've sunk a load of money investing in them, you then want them to basically carry on running until they're absolutely defunct. But I think that round the world, people are beginning to ask the question about whether we want nuclear power at all. And of course, the economics doesn't really add up unless you discount the fuel.
Well, it does. It does because this is zero carbon energy being produced in these plants.
Well, no, but that's not to do with economics. That's to do with zero carbon energy. That might be a goal in its own right. The real problem is what you do with the waste. And nobody's ever found out a realistic way of managing nuclear waste. When they tried to privatise the nuclear industry in the 1980s, I had to write a paper about this. When I worked for the New Economics Foundation, and the private sector looked at it and said, well, as long as we don't have to deal with the waste, we're really interested. But if we have to deal with the waste, where, you know, just one leakage could lead to payments of billions, just think about the people who are running Fukushima. They're now, you know, they'd be paying out a fortune in insurance and so on, and therefore it's not viable on a private sector basis.
Well, the other Martin, you know, you were working in engineering at Rolls-Royce. What are your thoughts about this? You must know a little bit about the engineering side of this.
Yeah, I think there must be some sort of risk assessment must have been done to look at the safety of it. But I think what this demonstrates, though, is I think the government policy now is to move more towards nuclear energy. I think there's just a deal's just been signed recently, I think, at Oldbury Power Station, where Hitachi will actually come in and build a power station. And for some reason, this government seems to have gone away with the or gone against the whole philosophy about windmills. I must admit, my local MP calls me somebody who's anti green belt. But having said that, I actually like the windmills around, and whether it's an economic way of actually producing power, I'd rather have lots of windmills stuck on green belt rather than a nuclear power station. But that's my personal
opinion. Is what they're planning, another one down there too, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, on to the sort of fallout from the Leveson inquiry. David Henke is named the Political Journalist of the Year at the British Journalism Awards this week, and he's written about what he calls the bonkers logic of Life of Brian Leveson. Unlike Hutton, he says, he really puts the boot in, and here I quote, He attacks what he calls the inappropriate closeness between the media bosses and successive governments, not just now, but for over 35 years. Thatcher, Major, Blair, Brown and Cameron are all indicted in a damning charge sheet. Leveson accuses them of being vulnerable to unaccountable interests, missing clear opportunities to address public concern about the culture, practices and ethics of the press too, and seeking to control, if not manipulate, the supply of news and information to the public in return for expected or hoped for favourable treatment by sections of the press. Martin Summers, this is a pretty damning little polemic here from the winner of the British Journalist of Political Journalist of the Year award.
Yes, I'm trying to work out what exactly his point is. Is he saying that Leveson hasn't gone far enough, or he's gone too far?
Well, he's holding fire on the idea of... He's not saying whether he thinks that there needs to be any kind of statutory regulation, but what he's saying is that the way that that the government, Cameron and the government, have dealt with it is clearly in the interests of the big media.
Well, that's fairly obvious. I mean, basically, Rupert Murdoch has told them what to do, and that's what they're doing. That's all there is to it, isn't it?
Yeah, I must admit that the whole question about regulation, I'm just completely, I must admit, sat on the fence to a certain extent, because I think if you had regulation and you had some sort of regulatory board, who's actually going to sort of appoint the chairman or the committee to that regulatory board? Is it then going to be politicians?
Well, we shall hear that it's an independent board, but whether it really is or not is very unlikely. I mean, I think the only my view on this is I think the only way you can have an independent board is if it's made up of people who've been victims of the press. People like Chris Jeffries from Clifton would make an ideal chair of such a board. But if it's going to be picked by, like the Ofcom consumer panel is, by corporate headhunters, Odgers, up in London, I mean, that was only a leak. I had a casual conversation with one of the employees at Ofcom a few years ago, and he said, oh yes, Odgers found us some really good consumer panel. Hang on a minute. They are corporate headhunters. They're going to find company men, people who will just be obedient. They're not going to be in any way independent.
So who appoints the company headhunters?
Maybe that's the chief executive of Ofcom that did that. But I mean, if we're going to have an independent panel, it needs to be, I think, of people who have been at the sharp end. And in a way, it's a really good way of dissuading editors from attacking people in the press that they shouldn't be, vulnerable people, by the thought that in a few weeks' time, that person could be making adjudications on their future decisions. Anyway, Martin, what do you think? Ultimately, what's going to happen with Leveson?
Well, I saw Bernstein, the Watergate investigative journalist on Channel 4 News last week, and he was saying, actually, what we've got here is criminal activity by the Murdoch Empire. And rather than getting a new board in to regulate things, stick with no regulation, but send Murdoch and his minions to prison. That's what he was saying. And in actual fact, that is the point. If the law has been broken, the existing law, then Murdoch's empire should be broken up and people should be sent to proper prisons, never mind regulation.
And of course, a lot of this comes back to whether the police are going to do their job or not, which they clearly didn't do with the phone hacking
case. Maybe they should be sent to prison too.
And the guy who was in charge of that, John Yates, who I keep repeating on here, he's now over helping the Bahraini police put down peaceful demonstrators and kill some of them over in Bahrain. He was in charge of the review of that case as to whether they were going to prosecute, and he said, oh, there's nothing really to see here, even though there was massive, massive evidence, quite clearly, of phone hacking going on. Onto a similar thing, and that is the Jimmy Savile and the paedophile cases. Now, for a long time, one of the headlines in The Sun was that several times, I think it was five times, maybe three times, that the police looked at prosecuting Savile and then said, no, we're not going to do it. So there is clearly a bit of a problem here. Anyway, I spoke to a child, he was at the time, a child actor, Ben Fellows, on this subject, about what are the wider causes of child abuse, and because we've seen, haven't we, and maybe I'll get your reaction on both of you on this, if you have a reaction, and that is to see people like Dave Lee Travis being arrested, sort of famous DJs, for certainly nothing to do with child abuse, but for sexual related offences, and also Max Clifford yesterday also being arrested. Craig Murray, the former ambassador to Uzbekistan, has put a post on his blog, and a lot of this stuff is being discussed on the blogs rather than in the newspapers, because the newspapers are quite nervous about it. He's saying a lot of this is just low-hanging fruit. It's cases that have been there for a long time, and that the police are not going for some of what are, you know, people like possible BBC people that allowed abuse to go on their premises and are leaving that aside. Anyway, we'd just like Martin Farmer first to say what your thoughts about this whole scandal.
Yeah, I think possibly one of the issues is, I'm just wondering if the police feel as if they go for some of the high profile names and get it wrong, then they'll get burnt, and the police will get burnt. I suppose
Martin, you know, Martin Summers.
Well, I think obviously I'm like everybody. I'm just watching as this stuff comes out. I do find it rather odd that all of this stuff suddenly comes out now, and I've got a suspicious frame of mind, and I think, well, why is this stuff coming out now? And it reminds me of what happened in the King Cora Boys Home scandal in Northern Ireland, Ken Livingstone's maiden speech in the House of Commons when he became an MP was about this, because MI5 were using the King Cora Boys Home as a honey trap for loyalist paramilitary leaders. So they would go in there, have sex with boys, it would all be videoed, and then they were being blackmailed by MI5. Now, when I hear paedophilia, I think blackmail. Who's blackmailing who? About what?
Interesting.
And I just wonder whether in all levels of society it's a case of, you know, whether it's happening with the Jimmy Savile, or literally in families, whether either people turn a blind eye, or they just can't believe it's happening, or it never happened to their family, and it's just people cover it up at various different levels throughout society, which I think is a tragedy.
Well, here's Ben Fellows in there, who's a former child actor, and he's really here talking about much wider causes of child abuse within the entertainment industry.
My name's Ben Fellows. A lot of people know me from being the 2012 Olympics whistleblower, but when I started my career, I was a child actor at the age of 10, and I went to a Saturday morning drama school, and the Royal Shakespeare Company were casting for their play Macbeth at Stratford, and I was cast to play Fleance. So from a very early age, I was basically moved straight into doing theatre, against my parents' wishes, I have to say. They weren't keen. I was obviously very keen, because it was something I was very good at. I liked messing about and playing with makeup and all that kind of stuff, so this was, you know, a big holiday. One thing I will say about the RSC was that they were excellent with their chaperones. They knew that they didn't know the people coming into their building. Yes, there were lots of very famous actors around and what have you, but you don't know who these people are as people, and they recognised that fact. And we were looked after. Basically, our parents dropped us off at the stage door into the hands of the chaperones, and the chaperones stayed with you basically all the time. You had a toilet in your dressing room, so you didn't need to go outside. We were told specifically not to go into actors' dressing rooms on our own, not to drink alcohol or anything like that. They were absolutely excellent. And when the BBC came, was being punished over the Jimmy Savile case, I just wanted to make the point that actually it's not just Jimmy Savile, it's the wider industry, but there are really good people in the industry as well, and they're sort of being let down by quite a few dodgy practices, whereby as a child actor, you'd go to an audition. Say I went to the Silver Young Theatre School, so then I would go for an audition in the afternoon. At the audition, you weren't chaperoned, and it's at the audition where you were basically, you know, take your top off or take your bottoms off. You know, on one occasion it was for a very sort of popular drinks commercial, and they asked me to basically take my top off, and they said, look, you're on the beach, so take your bottoms off. Now I had pants on, but I was, you know, 13 years old. You just do it, because there's a whole bunch of other kids outside, and that's the threat used over you all the time. And so, you know, they ask you things like, can you pretend to lick an ice cream and stuff like that. Now as a kid you just do it, but obviously it's quite dodgy. And over the next week or two, my parents were visited by the police to say that the pictures they had taken at that audition had been used in what they described as a paedophile catalogue, and had been circulated outside of the production company. So this was a major advertising agency who had hired a production company. That production company had produced photos of these children and then had used them in a catalogue to give off to a paedophile ring. And they asked us if we would be prepared to be witnesses in a court case, and there was hundreds of children used, so we were actually never called, but we were prepared to.
You say it's a wider thing in the industry. Certainly there were some serious problems at the BBC, there probably still are. Can you give us an idea of whereabouts you think those vulnerabilities are in the entertainment industry generally? You've just talked about auditions, where else?
Well, you know, even when you get the job, from my experience, I was sexually harassed all the time by both men and women. I had relationships with much older women in their 40s at the BBC.
I mean, actually on BBC premises?
Yeah, on BBC premises. And after work as well. I was actually promised by one of these producers, who's actually head of one of the children's BBC channels now, that basically if I played my cards right, in other words, if I had sex with her, then I would be on Blue Peter. And in actual fact, she got me an audition for Blue Peter. But again, it's one of the things that I call kind of a fake audition, where I was introduced to the editor of the programme. They were having their rehearsal and then sort of slotted me in. But I think that was more of a favour to the producer rather than it was me actually auditioning for real for the show, because it wasn't taken very seriously.
So how do we stamp this kind of thing out?
It's all about power and control and people being vulnerable. And anyone who's going into the entertainment industry, whether you're an adult or a child, are vulnerable. Just look at X Factor. You know, they've made a point of Simon Cowell looking the girls up and down and what have you, and winking and all that kind of stuff. Yes, of course, that, you know, not suggesting one moment that he's a paedophile or anything like that. But it's that sexualization of people and the idea that I'm the producer and I can make it happen for you if you play your cards right. In other words, if I like you or I like the how you speak to me or how you look at me, then I will help your career. And obviously sex is used as a control mechanism.
I think of that Lily Allen song where she says, take your clothes off because that's how you get famous. Do you think that's the reality, actually?
Yeah, that's exactly the reality. At auditions, I was basically told to have sex with people, which I didn't do. And so, therefore, you run the risk of not getting the job.
Did you report that at the time?
No, it wasn't like that. This was all the time it happened, you know. It wasn't just like a one-off occasion. You know, at stage school, you are trained not to complain about anything. I complained once about a teacher, and I was so sort of hounded by the school. They actually stopped me from going to any auditions for about a month. And as a child actor, you were going two or three times a week, minimum, really. So that was kind of a bit of a hell.
And but you're saying it's pretty much endemic. It's actually part of the business.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Even the stage school put me out to adults. I was asked to go to various West End shows and to basically entertain the adult actors afterwards, you know. So it goes from the stage schools straight through the professional industry. And of course, I think had I been gay, I would have got a lot deeper into it than I did. But because I was heterosexual, I sort of stayed on the outskirts of it, which was bad enough for me, I have to say.
Pretty shocking stuff there from the child actor, now turned freelancer, Ben Fellows. Martin, one of the most shocking things he was saying there was, well, after he complained about being sexually harassed, then he was told that you're not going to get any more auditions by his stage school.
Well, it reminds you of what used to happen when women used to complain of sexual harassment at work 30, 40 years ago. Shut up, you silly cow, don't worry about what are you getting upset about. And of course, we're now, as a society, beginning to realise that children are vulnerable and young people are vulnerable to sexual exploitation, because, you know, people in the past just thought that this wasn't going on. Now we know it is.
Yeah, I think it all comes back to where we were right at the start, where we're talking about, you know, some of the cuts that are happening right on the front line in some of our more vulnerable communities. There's a lot of vulnerable children out there. There's going to be cuts on the front line, and where do they go? Where are they safe when, you know, certain organisations are just going to disappear, such as youth centres.
Yeah. Now, final story, a bit more cheerful. BAE is committing £2.5 million and a site for the Concord Museum in Bristol. We've got about a minute on this, Martin Farmer.
So, very quickly, I mean, Filton Airfield, the last flight into Filton Airfield is going to be on the 21st of December. Filton Airfield itself will close on the 31st of December. BAE Systems, once there's approval from the council, will be able to sell the land from anywhere from between 30 and 100 million.
Isn't this BAE just sort of sweetening the pill, ultimately?
It's really a sop. It's almost like playing with people's emotions. Don't worry, we'll build a museum for Concord, but, you know, your industry, your aerospace industry in Bristol could actually be at risk with this airfield closing.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. That was Labour councillor for Cadbury Heath and Filton, Martin Farmer. After the news, hundreds of people every night now need free meals in Bristol. We talked to one, Alan Goddard, one of the people who provides those meals.
bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6. A nurse who worked at the hospital where the pregnant Duchess of Cambridge was being treated when a prank call was made has been found dead. Jacintha Saldana received a call from two Australian radio DJs pretending to be the Queen and Prince Charles. They were put through to the ward where the Duchess was staying. John Lofthouse is the chief executive of the King Edward VII Hospital in London.
Jacintha was a first-class nurse who cared diligently for hundreds of patients during her time with us. Everyone is shocked by the loss of a much loved and valued colleague.
David Cameron is to give his support to gay weddings in churches. In its response to a consultation on gay marriage next week, the government will announce that religious buildings that want to will be able to opt in to hosting ceremonies. But the Prime Minister says they don't have to.
If there is any church or any